Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Third Stream View. I'm your humble host, PK, and this is our show tonight for Monday evening, April 11th, 2011. Boy, the time is flying. As always, I want to thank BBS Radio for helping me continue to enjoy free speech and alternate media information, which is very important. So, guys, thanks again. I appreciate all that. Tonight, we're having back the great Jim Fetzer, who was on a couple weeks ago. Jim, as you may recall, is a 30-year college professor of philosophy and other good things. And he was a commissioned officer in the Marine Corps for 4 years. So he's got some good stuff together. And I've seen him on Fox News. I've seen him debate and discuss with Hannity and company. And I like his Teflon, his Teflon metal. And I'm sort of like the same way. So I was impressed by that. And I'm going to welcome him back here in a minute. I'm also excited about next week. I'm going to have on here on Third Stream View with PK, Karen Kwiatkowski. Karen is a retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel. And she's in the libertarian movement. I'm a fan of her writing, which I first saw at lewrockwell.com, which is a great website I wish everybody would read every day. Look through it. It's got some great things. Austrian economics, excellent scholarly revisionist history, all that good stuff. So anyway, I've gotten in contact with Karen, and she's been gracious enough to join me next week. We're going to be talking about the invasion of Iraq, which she opposed, and her insight on she saw the whole nesting of the hive of the neocons, as she was, because her office was in the Pentagon. As a matter of fact, she was there the day the Pentagon was attacked. So it'll be interesting to get her take on things. And she is certainly speaking truth to power. And again, here's another veteran. So I especially like speaking to vets, because it's really hard for the status quo opinion cartel, the Sean Hannitys, the Limbaughs, that whole crowd, to gang up on vets, because these vets are maybe taking a step outside, looking at things, and they're not afraid to speak their mind, and they're darn well they're patriotic, and they're not afraid to use their free speech, and they're not going to shut up because they too are going to speak truth to power. So I especially appreciate the vets who have, I hate to say seen the light, but I guess seen the light and have a different take on things. They love their country, as I do, but I fear my government, and I'm sure they probably do too. And what a government it is. Boy, they managed to cut spending. What was it, less than $50 billion or something they came together on the other day? Thank goodness the Republicans weren't allowed to kill all these women with allowing them to have cancer and all this sort of things they were talking about. I mean, heaven forbid they would cut money from the drug war, from overseas defense spending, from the bloated military budget, farm subsidies. Heaven forbid they would find other ways to cut spending. I was laughing during all this. It just continues. The one government party with two heads and the one bird of prey with two wings, the welfare warfare state and its apologists and those who thrive off of its gravy train continue to march forward. But as Curly would say, not me. So I stand opposed to their usual nonsense, always offering ways to cut spending, massive cuts in spending, and with solutions and taking care of the people who are going to be fired. We're going to have to fire a lot of bureaucrats to get this done. But I would suggest that they get their full pay and benefits for a year. And after that, they're on their own. Now, most of these people have college educations, and a thriving private sector would soon snap them up, because with massive tax cuts and elimination of a lot of government agencies, that would put a lot of money back into the hands of individuals and businesses to expand the private sector. We need a more healthy private sector. And I was reading something last week, and I think something like the number of people who are on the government payroll is exceeding those on the private sector. And that's very scary when that happens, because people on the government payroll really don't produce any wealth. It's the private sector. We need a healthy, strong, thriving private sector. I'm very pro free enterprise. I'm not pro business per se, I'm very pro free enterprise, and to get a more thriving private sector, as I never tire of saying, we need an atmosphere, an immediate atmosphere of micro taxes and micro regulations. That's the only way we're going to get there, and it doesn't seem like Congress wants to do that. So I, of course, always advocate nullifying all unconstitutional federal law with my evil goal of secession, because secession is good, secession is right, secession works. And by that, I don't mean civil war, and I certainly don't mean slavery, as the idiotic left likes to say. Oh, you want to have slavery again? Yeah, I want slavery again. How foolish is that? I want freedom from the central state, the central bureaucracy. I want liberty, property, and peace in a very strict, limited constitutional republic. I'm looking forward to having Jim Fetzer back on. Tonight we're going to speak more about 9/11, the events leading up to it, who we think the perpetrators are. I have my idea of who it is, and tonight I'm going to be slamming on Zionism. I'm going to be slamming on Israel. So put your seatbelt on and enjoy the ride, because free speech is here again. Jim, are you out there?
Yeah, I am, PK. Yes, I think your targets are pretty well taken.
Were you chuckling?
Oh, I was just saying, listening to your saying about Israel having had a role here, which I think is indeed the case.
Well, you realize that any discussion of Israel, any objective, intellectual, scholarly discussion, all immediately makes me anti-Semitic.
Well, you know, PK, I actually published an article about that. It's entitled, "Is 9/11 Research Anti-Semitic?" And I explain why it's clearly not, that you have to draw a distinction between discriminating against someone on the basis of their religion or their ethnic origin, as opposed to the actions or policies of their government, which is a completely different matter. Certainly the Zionist expansionist policies of the Israeli government are fair game for criticism and do not imply any intolerance or discounting of individuals on the basis of their religious orientation.
You are correct, sir. Too bad most of that crowd doesn't buy into that.
We want to hear something absurd, PK. It's when 9/11 truthers are compared with Holocaust deniers.
Right.
The situation, the comparison could not be more inappropriate, because the Holocaust deniers, of course, deny that their government, in this case the German government, committed atrocities involving the deaths of millions of gypsies, Jews, and others, whereas 9/11 truthers affirm that their government was involved in bringing about the deaths of 3,000 American citizens. So they couldn't really be compared remotely. It's a ridiculous complaint.
You're right. And let me get myself in some more hot water here. Therefore, only Jewish suffering is special and unique, not the Russian Holocaust or what happened to the Ukraine or the 1.5 million Armenians or the American Indians or the, 40 to 60 million that Mao murdered since World War II, or the 2 million who died in Cambodia, or the, almost a million who died in Rwanda. I guess that I am full of hate for mentioning those historical facts.
Well, actually, of course, it just means you're more historically aware than most of those who use such crude arguments to try to suppress inquiry, which is perfectly legitimate. I even think that laws against Holocaust denials are absurd, BK. I mean, Holocaust was real, as I happen to believe, then research will support it. And if it doesn't, then we're certainly all entitled to know. If we've been believing in a myth, then that's something that deserves to be exposed.
Well, I would be considered, in Europe at least, I would be considered a Holocaust denier. I do not deny that millions of people died and there was forced marches and forced labor and genocide and torture. I clearly acknowledge all of those things, but I have serious questions about the details, the methodology, and the intent. So just for speaking like this, with no hatred involved, with not advocating violence or genocide towards anyone, I would be considered a Holocaust denier, and they're throwing people in jail left and right for exercising what should be their free speech.
Yeah, it's completely ridiculous.
It is ridiculous.
When I was growing up and going to the kids' theaters, for example, at the Rialto in South Pasadena, we used to have newsreels then. You remember, you used to have previews, newsreels, a cartoon, as well as the main feature.
I've seen those historical things.
Endless newsreels from World War II showing stacks of bodies at the concentration camps when they were liberated. It made an indelible impression in my mind. But I think there's lots of latitude for serious research on the numbers, who was incarcerated, how many were put to death, whether they were slave labor camps or whether there's something more was going on. I think that's all perfectly legit.
You know, I've been studying this a lot, and I would love to have this discussion with you in the future about this whole Holocaust thing and this whole thing we're touching on, because it needs to come to the surface and it needs to be discussed more. There's even some prominent Jewish writers and authors who speak about this. Of course, and here's something I delight in saying, that a lot of Jewish authors and writers or intellectuals who are anti-Zionist or who write critically of Israel and Zionism and or Jewish power are often referred to as self-hating Jews and anti-Semitic. Those are the two terms that try to shut down their free speech and the way that they're trying to be rejected out of hand. And I don't buy that. I think it's nonsense.
Yeah, well, you're of course correct. It's political rhetoric to use the term that way. In fact, the classification of being a Semite is a linguistic one, and it applies to all of the languages spoken by the Arabs, though not the Persians, not the Iranians, so that since the Palestinians are Arabic and are Semitic, when the Israelis create the largest concentration camp in the world in Gaza, they are practicing anti-Semitism with a vengeance.
You're correct. And by the way, I'm an American who actually knows that the Persian language is Farsi. What do you think about that?
Yes, well, you're of course right.
Would you give me a gold star, teacher?
Well, you're more enlightened than many of our fellow citizens, I'm sorry to say. Interestingly, by the way, I cannot imagine any decent argument as to why Iran isn't entitled to have a few nukes of its own. By the way, Israel has 200 to 600 of these beauties. Iran could never use them for offensive purposes without risking national annihilation. They only function defensively to let an aggressor nation know that if they strike Iran, that they could run the risk of feeling a retaliation. So I just don't understand the argument that would deny the Iranians the right to have a few nuclear weapons.
Well, Jim, your reasoning is exactly correct about that. In fact, I mentioned this before. I like to say this little juicy detail because I am the author of this acronym, I think it is. Iran stands for Israel Requires American Naivety. Because, Jim, you must realize, and I'm telling all of America, you must certainly realize that all of Israel's problems or threats against them are equally America's problems, because whatever affects them is automatically affects America. I don't know if you knew that.
Well, you know, PK, that's what the dancing Israelis said when they were arrested in their white van from Urban Moving Systems. When the police officer walked up, the driver turned to him and said, we are not your problem. Your problem is our problem. The problem is the Palestinians. And, of course, these were five guys who were observed at Liberty State Park in New Jersey celebrating dancing while they filmed the destruction of the Twin Towers. They were later incarcerated and held for some 71 days before an assistant to then-Attorney General John Ashcroft directed their release. They went back to Israel, and three of them appeared on Israeli television. You can Google dancing Israelis and you'll find a clip where they explained that they were there in order to record, to document the destruction of the Twin Towers. Needless to say, they couldn't have been there for that purpose unless they had advanced knowledge that the Twin Towers were going to be destroyed, and that the assistant to the Attorney General who directed their release was Michael Chertoff, a joint U.S.-Israeli citizen who would subsequently be appointed our Director of Homeland Security.
You beat me to it. I was going to mention that. Yes, I happen to know those details, and of course, he helped spirit them away. They didn't stay. They weren't here too long. I think they were here maybe a month or two. Weren't they held?
Well, believe it or not, PK, there were some 200 Israeli, quote, art students who were here in the country. They all appear to have been working for the Mossad, and many of them were involved in tracking the alleged hijackers, I think, just so they would know where they were at what times so that they could be sure to frame them. It's interesting that the CIA has its agents keep diaries so that if they ever need to create an alibi for one of their agents, they know where to not place them as a way of creating a fabricated excuse.
And as I'm fond of saying, Jim, the CIA, Britain's MI6, and Mossad, they work together, and of course they are together the masters of deception, and Mossad's mantra, I'm sure you know, is by deception we make war.
Yes, absolutely. That's correct.
So getting back to 9/11, which, of course, we know, Jim, you and I, let's be man-to-man about this. We know that Osama bin Laden pulled this off with a laptop in a cave in Afghanistan. He's a brilliant technician. But,
well, you know, it's really quite absurd, PK. The Icelandic, now German scholar Elias Davidson, D-A-V-I-D-S-S-O-N, has published an article in which he explains that the government has never been able to place any of those hijackers aboard any of those planes. In fact, the situation is that two of those flights, 11 and 77, where 11 allegedly hit the North Tower and 77 the Pentagon, weren't even scheduled to fly that day. David Ray Griffin has published articles in Global Research in which he has explained that all of those cell phone calls from the four planes were faked. Colonel George Nelson, a U.S. Air Force air crash investigator, has observed that of the four crash sites, although there are millions of uniquely identifiable component parts from those planes, the government has yet to produce even one. And I have FAA deregistration data that shows that two of those flights, as I recall, it was again 11 and 77, were not deregistered, meaning not shown to be no longer serviceable until the following year, and the other two flights not until 2005. So apparently at least two of those planes were flying around as long as 4 years after they had allegedly been destroyed on 9/11.
Jim, you think there's any truth to the possibility of perhaps Mossad electronically flying the planes into the buildings?
No, the evidence indicates that the use of the planes was pretty much of a phantom flight. At Shanksville in Pennsylvania, for example, the plane, Flight 93, is alleged to have disappeared into soft ground when it crashed, and that's the reason there are no plane parts there. I mean, you're talking about 100-ton airliners. You should have a massive pile of aluminum debris, wings, the
somewhere
tail broken off body seats, luggage. It simply disappeared. Two of the first reporters on the scene independently remarked that the most eerie aspect of the crash site was there was no indication that any plane had crashed there. One of the stories, PK, is that the plane disappeared into an abandoned mine shaft, and that's why we couldn't see it. But we know what to do with the miners trapped in abandoned mine shafts. We bring out the bright lights and the heavy equipment and dig 24/7 in the hope that by some miracle someone will have survived. But none of that was done on this occasion. And in fact, the reporters were kept 1,000 yards away. And after they sort of tidied up the scene, they actually even trimmed the burned trees and shrubbery so it couldn't be subjected to a chemical analysis. The whole thing at Shanksville was phony. The Pentagon was a very striking case of using Hollywood-style special effects. Officially, the plane flew in in a northeasterly direction at an acute angle to the building, the west side of the Pentagon, which was an odd choice for terrorists because it had just been rebuilt, reinforced, so that if anything happened to the West Wing, it would be most unlikely to do any damage to other parts of the building. It was also the part of the building that had the least personnel and files. In fact, those who appeared to have been there were primarily accountants and financial analysts who were trying to track the $2.3 trillion
right.
that Donald Rumsfeld had announced was missing from the Pentagon budget the day before. Where the controller of the Pentagon, PK, during the time this money went missing, was a fellow named Dov Zakheim, who was also a joint U.S.-Israeli citizen. It turns out the official trajectory of this plane flying some 757, just barely skimming the ground and taking out several lampposts, is aerodynamically impossible. There's something called ground effect, which is the accumulation of a packet of compressed gas, in this case air, beneath the fuselage, that would have made it impossible for that plane at that speed to get closer than some, say, 60 feet to the ground, about one wing length. And if it had hit any of those lampposts because the fuel is stored in the wings, they would have burst into fire. I mean, the effect of a plane flying 500 miles an hour and hitting a stationary lamppost is the same as the plane being stationary and being hit by a lamppost moving 500 miles an hour. If you ever look at the damage that's done to a commercial aircraft in flight by a tiny bird, for example, that weighs only a few ounces, you realize how absurd it is to suggest that this plane on this aerodynamically impossible trajectory could have hit any lamppost and continued on that same trajectory, moving straight forward. The wing would have been ripped off. It would have been twisted around. The tail would have broken off. Body seats, luggage everywhere. None of that happened. Not only that, but flying so close to the ground, the lawn should have been torn up and seriously damaged. In fact, we have the two civilian lime green fire trucks showing up almost immediately after there's an explosion at the Pentagon. And the lawn, they put out these very modest fires in 10 or 15 minutes, and the lawn is still perfectly clear. There's no debris. It's about as nice as you would expect at the Masters in Augusta. You might even think Tiger is going to show up with his caddy to practice his putting. What did wow. happen, PK, is that a commercial carrier was flown on a easterly trajectory toward the building at a much higher altitude, some 300 feet in the air, too high to hit any of those lampposts. When it was 1 second away from the building, it was still 100 feet above the building. It swerved off and flew over it. At approximately the same time, an explosion was set off. We have a civilian employee by the name of April Gallup who had brought her infant to work that day, who was in the vicinity of the explosion. And after it had taken place, she actually walked out through the massive hole. Well, it was about 10 feet high and 17 feet wide, and reported she saw no indications of any aircraft having crashed there. So the whole thing at the Pentagon is another hoax. In fact, one of the fascinating aspects of the Pentagon is, as I explained, those modest fires were extinguished by the lime green civilian fire trucks, and yet hours later, when there was a rumor that the Capitol was a target, and all the members of the House of Representatives and the Senate rushed out onto the steps, when they looked across the Potomac toward the Pentagon, they saw massive billowing black clouds. And you have to ask where those came from. Well, it turns out they came not from the building, but from an enormous series of dumpsters in front of it. If you go to my article online, What Didn't Happen at the Pentagon, you'll see three photographs I have of the cloud billowing out of these enormous dumpsters. It was a prop. It was a special effect, Hollywood style. And when I was still living in Duluth, where I retired from the University of Minnesota in 2006, another 9/11 researcher came by and showed me 44 more frames, PK, which also showed the dumpsters and the smoke billowing from them from a different angle where you could actually see light between the dumpsters and the building. And none of this, as I indicated before, came from the building. It was as phony as it could be.
Well, that's interesting. Thank you for that, sharing that. I used to think, because I haven't looked into the Pentagon that much, but I used to wonder, well, if a plane hit it, was it accompanied by a missile?
Well, The Pentagon actually surreptitiously released 5 frames initially. There were as many as 84 videos. I mean, the Pentagon is the most secure building in the world. There, if you look at the building, there's one every 100 feet, a camera across the top of the roof of the building.
Right.
And if they had wanted to show us what had happened at the Pentagon, in fact, it would have been easy to do so. Instead, they released these 5 frames that showed a growing fireball. And the very first one is conveniently labeled plane. And if you study it very carefully, just above a gate mechanism, you can see what appears to be the silhouette of an aircraft, but it's much too small to be a Boeing 757. Jack White, who's a legendary photo analyst from JFK research, sized the image of a Boeing 757 to the tail of this plane, and the 757 at 155 feet was more than twice as long as the plane shown, which was only about 76 feet long, which was much too small. There is a plume of white smoke, however, trailing from it that pilots and aeronautical engineers have told me would not be from a jet engine, but could be from a missile, which has led me to speculate that about the same time this larger plane was flying over the building, a much smaller plane may have approached it and fired a missile into that section of the building to kill those budget analysts trying to track the money. The $2.3 trillion, there was a study of the support columns, the damage to the support structure of the Pentagon by A.K. Dewdney and Ralph Longspaugh that I cited in an article of mine entitled Thinking About Conspiracy Theories, 9/11 and JFK, which anyone can access by just doing a search on the Internet. They said that the damage to the support columns was inconsistent with a large plane like a 757, but consistent with a much smaller plane like an F-16 or possibly an A-3 Sky Warrior. So wow. I have entertained that hypothesis for some time. I'm now convinced, however, that the fireball photographs are fake for the following reason. When they excavated where the roof collapsed, and this was like 20 or 30 minutes after the initial explosion, it showed no indications of any damage from a tremendous fire such as would have occurred had a big commercial carrier actually collided with the building. In fact, on the second or third floor, you can be a stand. You see a wooden stand there holding what appears to be an Oxford Unabridged Dictionary. There's no indication of any singeing or burning. So I now today believe those fireball photographs were all fake.
Wow. You know, back to the Pennsylvania where the plane allegedly crashed. Jim, wasn't Rumsfeld, didn't he make a slip and say, didn't he at one time say he hit with a missile or something? Didn't he say something like that once? You know about that?
Yeah. Well, Rumsfeld, or it might have been Cheney, who talked about Flight 93 possibly have been shot down with a missile. There is a report of a Major Rick Gibney, who was from a hotshot Air National Guard unit normally stationed in Fargo, North Dakota, but which was on temporary assignment to Andrews Air Force Base, having shot it down with a couple of Sidewinder missiles. But Rumsfeld also slipped in one point and said, talked about a missile hitting the Pentagon. So I think we got two different reports of the possible use of missiles here. But it's all been, you know, very much obscured by the administration, which doesn't want anyone to really have any idea what actually happened on 9/11.
Of course, in the continuing administration, Obama, they certainly don't want to look into it either, nor would the next one, nor the next one, correct?
Well, it's very embarrassing. You know, I mean, we had this succession of presidents after the assassination of JFK that would never have occupied that office but for his death. The first obviously being Lyndon Johnson, who appears to have played a major role, been the pivotal figure in bringing about the assassination. Then, of course, he was succeeded by Richard Nixon, who appears to have attended a ratification meeting at the home of Clint Murchison the night before, where he was observed by Madeline Duncan Brown, who was a mistress of Lyndon, who had an affair with him that began in 1948, and she bore him a son, Stephen, in 1950, not Lyndon's only child out of wedlock, but his only male offspring. And Madeline talked about how Nixon had been driven out there by a Republican leader who worked in the same bank building in Dallas, where she was a young advertising executive. Others who were there included J. Edgar Hoover. Madeline thought maybe he was the guest of honor. George Brown at Brown and Root Heavy Construction, when the Vietnam War went down, Brown and Root got $1 billion to create a new port at Cam Ranh Bay, even though Vietnam has many magnificent natural ports and it wasn't really necessary to create one. John J. McCloy, who'd been our high commissioner to Germany and the former chief executive officer at Chase Manhattan Bank, was also there. H.L. Hunt, who was a competitor with Clinton Murchison as another of the great oil barons, was there. And when Lyndon showed up late in the evening, these guys all disappeared into a boardroom for 15 or 20 minutes. And when it broke up, Lyndon strode over toward Madeline. She thought he was going to whisper sweet nothings in her ear. Instead, he told her in a hateful tone of voice that after tomorrow, he wasn't going to have to put up with embarrassment from those Kennedy boys any longer. And wow. She also reported and described in a book she authored entitled Texas in the Morning, which took its name from the fact that when she and Lyndon would have rendezvous, he'd get up in the morning at the hotel, throw open the windows, take a big breath and say, God, I love Texas in the morning. So she used that as the title of her book. Well, they had such a rendezvous on New Year's Eve, just 6 weeks after the assassination, at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin, Texas, where she confronted Lyndon with rumors rampant in Dallas at the time that he'd been involved, since no one stood to gain more personally. He blew up at her and told her the oil boys and the CIA had decided that Jack had to be taken out. That's a report that's been confirmed by Billy Saul Estes in his book, A Texas Legend, and, of course, by E. Howard Hunt in his Final Confessions, published in Rolling Stone. Wow. Both of them were reporting that Lyndon was involved at the top of the heap. And Howard Hunt said he was a backbencher during the assassination, but also identified Court Meyer, who was in charge of covert activities at the time, and William Harvey, David Sanchez Morales, and others as having been involved. Billy Saul knew Cliff Carter, who was LBJ's chief administrative assistant, and told a French investigative reporter, William Raymond, in an earlier interview that Lyndon had sent his Cliff Carter down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements were in place for the assassination. He also knew Malcolm Mack Wallace, who was Lyndon's personal assassin. He murdered a dozen or more people on Lyndon's behalf, including one of his sisters, who apparently was getting too talkative, but including a federal marshal, a federal investigator from the Department of Agriculture by the name of Henry Marshall, who was shot 5 times with a single-shot bolt-action rifle, had carbon monoxide in his lungs and a concussion, and the accommodating justice of the peace declared it was a suicide.
Well, at least Lyndon Johnson kept the Vietnamese from coming ashore on our West Coast. Listen, we've got a call on line 2 from Rebecca. Rebecca, are you out there?
Hi, yes, I am. Thank you for taking my call.
Welcome to Third Stream View.
Hey, this is awesome. I had a friend who was on Flight 93, and he had called his family beforehand because he knew the plane was going to go down, and you had talked about the calls were fabricated. So
that's right.
How would that have happened? And I believe you. I'm not, you know.
Who was this? Do you remember the name?
Yeah, I know who it was. It was Mark Bingham.
Mark Bingham? You know, Bingham, it's a fascinating story. He's the left roll guy who was supposed to have, you know, organized them to use a drink cart to try to break down the cabin door. He calls his mother and says, hey, Mom, this is Mark Bingham. And she reported later that it wasn't a normal conversation, you know, that he was talking to her, but he wasn't answering her questions. And David has conjectured that it was probably fabricated conversation using voice morphing, or it could be that this was something that was prepared in advance for an alleged anti-terrorist drill, but it's pretty clear it wasn't legit. In fact, this is very interesting. When the trial took place in Alexandria, Virginia, of Zacharias Massawi, he was allegedly the 20th hijacker, to determine whether he should suffer life imprisonment or the death penalty. The argument was made that if he had only come forward and confessed his involvement, some lives might have been saved. But the whole thing was phony because he'd been convicted a year before, not of involvement in 9/11, but of the attack on the Twin Towers in 1993 involving the blind sheik. He had denied at the time he had anything to do with 9/11. But a year later, in April, and I actually went to the federal courthouse with Colonel George Nelson, whom I previously mentioned, and with Phil Berg, who was a former deputy attorney general for the state of Pennsylvania. And we made statements about the trial being a fraudulent event because the federal prosecutors had to know that this was a shell game they were playing. Massali was equipped with a 5,000-volt stun belt, which would make even me accommodating under those conditions. Well, what's most fascinating about the transcript from the plane, which they played, was that one of my members of Scholars for 9/11 Truth wrote me to say there was a problem here because the recording of the passengers, including Mark Bingham, preparing to hit the cabin door with a drink cart, was from a cockpit voice recorder, and what he observed was that cockpit voice recorders do not record voices in the passenger compartment. Another member of Scholars, who is a Muslim, observed that at the end of the flight, when the, you know, instead of allowing the passengers to regain control, the alleged terrorists deliberately crashed the plane. They say at the end, Allah Akbar, as their final prayer, which of course translates as God is great, God is great. But as a Muslim member of Scholars wrote to me, in Islam, there's a prayer for every occasion. And if you're facing imminent death, the prayer you should give is, there is but one God, Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet, in Arabic, of course, which means that those who were writing the script for Flight 911 didn't know enough to get it right.
Rebecca.
What about that Todd Beamer who said, let's roll? That could be fabricated as well then with voiceover?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, good. Todd Beamer, yes. He and Mark Bingham were two of the notable figures aboard Flight 93, if there were such a flight. It's all really quite amazing how much chicanery and fraud has gone on here. I believe that the astonishing stand-down that took place that morning, where the whole American Air Force was basically neutralized, they had changed the requirements for allowing a plane to be sent up against the hijacked aircraft so that now you had to get, this was on the 1st of June, you had to get permission from the Secretary of Defense. But there were also, as Webster Tarpley has reported in the expanded preface to the second edition of his book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in the USA, there were as many as 17 different anti-hijacking drills that kept the American Air Force completely out of it. Some planes were sent in the wrong directions. Most weren't responding whatsoever. There were blips on the radar screen where the air traffic controllers couldn't tell if it was real or imaginary. And I believe it was all intended to prevent any plane from going up to intercept hijacked aircraft that weren't there. If you remember the classic film War Games, where the Pentagon has this computer called the Whopper. It's actually at the Crystal Palace in the mountains in Colorado. Outside of Denver, the Whopper thinks that the simulated attack is a real attack and is preparing to launch all of our missiles against the Soviet Union. So, Crystal, when the Whopper reports a couple of these bison bombers, these Russian bombers crossing Alaska, Crystal Palace sends up a couple of American fighter aircraft to intercept them. And when they report back, they say, nothing here, the sky's all clear. That's when he realized this whole thing was, a mistake by the computer, confusing an illusion for reality. Well, I think that Cheney and the others wanted to make sure no one went up to intercept planes that they would find weren't actually there.
Well, I had heard like NORAD was offline or told to stand down or, you know, normally they would just be all over that stuff.
True. That's exactly right. Yeah, the normal coordination between the FAA and NORAD was non-existent on 9/11. And you got to ask yourself, well, how were those 19 Islamic fundamentalists able to arrange that? You know, I mean, it's really remarkable how much control they had. Here's something else that'll fascinate you about the planes in New York, which appear to be some form of fakery as well, as surprising as that may seem. There's a fellow by the name of Leslie Raphael who has done a fascinating study about Jules Naudet's film of the hit by Flight 11 on the North Tower, and points out how there were simply 100 different considerations that had to be taken into account in order to get their cameraman in exactly the right place at exactly right time to swing his camera up to catch whatever it was that hit the North Tower just the way he did. It's really a fascinating article. Rosalie Grable has done a time sequencing of the image seen in the Naudet brothers film. And when you time sequence, it's something is flying toward building one, the North Tower. But it certainly doesn't look like a Boeing 757. It looks like maybe an arrangement of closely spaced unmanned aerial vehicles. Something very strong, strange is going on there. And in relation to the hit on the South Tower, Flight 175, the plane is flying at an impossible speed, just as at the Pentagon, I explained. Here, the 767 now is flying at 560 miles an hour at 700 to 1,000 feet altitude. Well, that's what it can make at 35,000 feet, where the air is three times thinner. But at the much lower altitude, where it's three times thicker, it can't possibly fly that fast because the turbines can't suck the air through the engines, and they start functioning as brakes. In fact, Pilots for 9/11 Truth has just released a new documentary, Rebecca. It's called 9/11 Intercepted, in which they discuss what was happening on 9/11 and point out that it was not only impossible for a 767 to travel at the speed shown in the film, but that if a plane had been flying that fast, it would have been impossible to pilot. You couldn't navigate it. You couldn't manage it. And it would start falling apart physically. Now, I think the reason they had to fake these flights is because they were having explosions that had been previously set up to go off in the sub-basements right at the same time the planes were supposed to hit the towers, so that they could explain the explosions as resulting from jet fuel falling through the elevators. So it turns out that William Rodriguez, who was the senior custodian in the North Tower, reported how this explosion had occurred seconds before there were any reverberations from the alleged plane impact, which appears to have been created by an explosive charge set up very high in each of the towers. So that two scholars, members of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, published an article entitled Seismic Proof 9/11 Was an Inside Job, in which they reported the seismic data from the Lamont Laboratory, run by Columbia University, and compared it with FAA and military radar data about the exact time when the alleged impact occurred. And they found there was a discrepancy that these explosions in the sub-basement, this is in both buildings, occurred anywhere from 14 to 17 seconds before the alleged impact of the planes. So that, you know, this is the reason they had to fake it. They had to try to control the impact of the plane so closely with the explosions in the sub-basement, they could explain away the explosions in the sub-basement, but they didn't get it quite right. So, but that, I think, is why they had to fake it. Plus, it's very difficult flying at a high speed to hit one of these buildings. In fact, not long after 9/11, a group of members of Pilots for 9/11 Truth went to simulators, and there were a dozen of them who tried, and virtually none of them could do it. I think Rob Basalmo, who's the head of the organization, tried to hit the building and was able to do it maybe one time in 10. So, you know, they couldn't allow that kind of nonsense to take place. So they faked it.
Jim. So my next question is, where did those planes go?
Well, see, I don't think they actually ever existed. I think that the alleged passengers were a mix of phony names and real names, and maybe there were some persons who wanted to, you know, disappear or who knows what. It's all very strange, Rebecca. But basically, I've been forced by the evidence to the conclusion that those were phantom flights.
Okay. I mean, this guy disappeared. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well.
And then, of course, they said they found a little piece of phone
I'd be interested to know
DNA.
If there's any good reason.
There could be anything they sent back. You know what I mean? So.
Yeah.
It's
Rebecca,
interesting to know where all
I've got to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Isn't it great and interesting to hear people like Jim Fetzer speaking on this? And don't you wish that this was the norm, that was out in the open, that was much more discussed freely without intimidation? And by the way, especially someone like Jim, who is a four-year officer in the Marine Corps, right away you can't question his patriotism, so they can't play that trick.
I know. I've been kind of hearing bits and pieces all along, so I nowhere know all the names like he does. But, you know, it's totally right on. Apparently there was a woman that got interviewed right after one of the towers got hit, and she had said she heard this explosion. Well, I was listening on another show on BBS Radio, and people are talking about whatever happened to that interview that lady did. Because, you know, a lot of people were interviewed, you know, the news people were running all over. But then it's kind of like, what happened to a lot of those interviews about people who said they heard an explosion? You know, just
If you look at the classic 9/11 film Loose Change, you'll find they interview firefighters, and some of them are saying, boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
Now, Richard Gage, who's the head of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, was here in Madison and gave a presentation on Thursday that I attended. And during the film footage, he showed it had a thermal aspect to it, and you could actually see it transited from made a transition from normal photography and color to a kind of a thermal imaging. It looked like you have sections of about 10 floors at a time that were exploding in advance of the falling debris. It was really fascinating. I have to find out where that came from. It may or may not be a part of their Blueprint for Truth, which is a documentary they produced some time ago.
Yeah, in that plane crash at Shawshank, I saw that, and I'm like, this doesn't make sense. You know, for any plane that goes down, there's sure a lot more debris. It was like, where'd everything go?
Yeah, there was nothing there. You're absolutely right. That's what the reporters said. I mentioned before, they said, the weird thing about this crash site was there was no indication that any plane had crashed there.
I know. It would be interesting, though, to find out ever where some of these people did go. You know what I mean?
Yeah, if they this is an interesting difference, Rebecca. The families of the alleged passengers who benefited from the Survivors Fund are very uninterested in talking about what happened. I think they know they got some benefit, then they think they didn't really deserve it, and they don't want to talk about it because they don't want it to be taken away. The families of those who died on in the Twin Towers, for example, are very eager to find out what happened, who was responsible, and how it was done. Here's something else. A member of scholars did a study of the 19 persons who allegedly made phone calls, and they found that of the 19, the number who were listed on the Social Security Death Index was exactly one, and the number of families who had received money from the Survivors Fund was none. So that was very suspicious all by itself. That was something a member did years and years ago.
If I remember, I don't think Mark talked to his mom. I don't think his mom was at the house when he called.
No, she talked about it later. You're talking about Mark Bingham. Because he not only said, you know, Mom, this is Mark Bingham. I mean, when's the last time you called your mother and had to give your full name? You know, that's ridiculous on its face. But she actually described the conversation and said it wasn't ordinary. You know, she was asking questions, but he wasn't responding to her. He was saying things, but it wasn't a conversation between them, which supports the idea that this was some kind of voice morphing.
Right. Well, one more thing I want to say, and then I'll let you go, is isn't it like anywhere from like 47 to 52% of the population now believes that there was a conspiracy?
I think that's right. Certainly that percentage no longer believes what we were told on 9/11, but then again, neither do the chairs of the 9/11 Commission, both Hamilton and the other chair. They published a book saying they were misled, and that the Pentagon gave them three different stories about what happened on 9/11. William Hamilton and then the former governor in New Jersey. They were both completely keen. They were both completely disillusioned of their experience. you know, Max Cleveland, former senator from Georgia, actually withdrew from the 9/11 commission early on because it was obvious to him it was rigged. And it turns out that the executive director, Philip Zelikow, had actually drafted a complete outline of the report, the final report, a year before he shared it with any member of the staff. And that Philip Zelikow, when I did research on him, I was astonished to discover that his area of academic expertise was the creation and maintenance of public myths, M-Y-T-H-S. That was his area of academic specialization, and that's what he gave us. He gave us a myth, a public myth.
Does he have a dual passport, too? I'm serious.
No, but I'm quite sure. I don't believe so, but I'm sure he's a neocon. You know, I mean, many of those who were behind the project for the New American Century and who held the prominent positions, especially in the Department of Defense, were joint U.S.-Israeli citizens, were some of the prime movers, some of the most important figures that appear to have been involved here include Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Donald Five, Paul Wolfowitz, William Kristol, you know, Charles Krauthammer, General Richard Meyer, of course, Larry Silverstein and Rudy Giuliani, all of these appear to have been involved. And there was a lot of fishiness going on in the Port Authority in New York and getting the World Trade Center put into private hands 6 weeks before the events of 9/11. And, of course, Larry Silverstein got this huge anti-terrorist insurance on the buildings. And because there were purportedly two planes, he claimed it was double indemnity, and he wound up getting something like $4.4 billion in insurance for an investment he had made of $114 million. That's not a bad return on your money.
Speaking of 9/11, it's amazing how many people, Americans, still have never heard of the collapse of World Trade Center Building Number 7. It's amazing how many people don't know about it.
Yeah. Well, Richard, when he was here, talked about the Twin Towers and Building 7. And, of course, 7 wasn't hit by any plane, didn't have any jet fuel-based fires. Jet fuel, by the way, is simply kerosene, and it burns at a relatively low temperature. In fact, after most of the fuel was consumed in those spectacular fireballs, the fires that endured didn't burn neither hot enough nor long enough to cause steel to weaken, much less melt. I mean, those massive 500,000-ton steel and concrete buildings were an enormous heat sink, meaning if you tried to heat up the steel in any one location, it would be dissipated throughout the steel throughout the whole building. So it was virtually impossible to create conditions under which the steel would melt, even under ideal circumstances. NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which had the primary responsibility for conducting a scientific investigation, sampled 236 pieces of steel from the remnants and discovered that 233 had not been exposed to temperatures above 500 degrees, which is the temperature of an ordinary office fire. And, you know, that there's no way in which the steel would have been adversely affected by 500-degree fires. I mean, if that were true, then you would never have to have controlled demolition of any building. You just set fire to some of the furniture in the office and let it burn itself down. In fact, before 9/11, no steel structure high-rise had ever collapsed due to fire, nor after 9/11. And if our research is correct, it didn't happen on 9/11 either. There is an important difference between Building 7 and the Twin Towers, however. With Building 7, you have a classic controlled demolition. You can see the explosion go to the side, up the top, from the bottom, up the side, over to the top. There's this classic kink. All right. The floors are falling at the same time, approximately free fall speed. And when it's over, you have a stack of debris or a pile of pancakes about equal to 12% of the original height at 47, that would be 4.7 plus another 2%, or about 5.5 floors, which is what you had. With the Twin Towers, however, they used some novel technique. Those buildings were destroyed from the top down, and they used very powerful explosive to convert them mostly into very fine dust. And when it was all done, there was virtually nothing there. I had Father Frank Morales, who was an Episcopal priest from St. Mark's Church, who was a first responder on my shows twice, my own radio programs, and he told me the buildings were actually destroyed below ground level. Now, the reason it was essential to convert these buildings into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust is that the Twin Towers were constructed inside what is called the bathtub. It was like a moat to ensure that Hudson River water didn't pour in under the foundation of Lower Manhattan, which may be the most valuable real estate in the world. It would have flooded the PATH train tunnels, the subway tunnels. It would have created a huge problem. So they had to make sure that virtually the vast majority of the mass of those buildings never collapsed, because once you convert it into very fine dust, it just remained suspended in the air. It wound up falling on streets of New York and eventually blowing out to sea. So they had to use some novel technique to bring that about. That's one of the hard problems that we're still working on solving, how they managed to destroy the Twin Towers to ensure that the bathtub would remain intact.
Was there a mini nuke?
I'll tell you the truth. I'm gravitating toward the possibility that mini nukes may have been used. I was mentioning how when Richard Gage showed this these films, videos of the destruction of the towers, they had it turned into a thermal map, and you could actually see the brighting up from the explosions inside the building. And it looked like it was taking out about 10 floors at a time. Now, if you got a 110-story building and you're taking out roughly 10 stories at a time, apart from the initial demolition, which may have been, you know, just as a smoke screen, then you're going to get something like a boom, 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 just like the firemen reporting. And you're only going to need about 10 of them if you are, in fact, using mini nukes. So based on my research, that is one of the hypotheses that still appears to be viable.
Well, some of the footage I saw showed the firemen across the street on the phone after the building was already hit, but you could still hear bombs going off in the down below. And he's trembling as he's on the phone.
Yeah, you're saying that's after the buildings have been destroyed?
No, after the buildings were hit, before they collapsed, you could still hear bombs going off in the basement.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. There was a fellow who worked for the emergency management unit in New York named Barry Jennings, who actually had gone into Rudy Giuliani's command and control center, which was something like the 27th and the 28th floors. And when he got up there, he found, you know, sandwiches, half-eaten coffee that was still steaming. Someone noticed him there and said, "We got to get you out." And he reported there were explosions going on inside Building 7. This is in the morning. The whole time he was in there, that at one point it was dark, he couldn't see, but he could tell he was stepping over bodies. At one point, a stair casing was blown out virtually from under him. So he was very fortunate to get out of the building alive. That was a classic controlled demolition, and a lot of very strange stuff was going on in Building 7.
Well, I'm thinking with the Twin Towers, of course, thermite, and the possibility of some mini nukes or something that was planted, you know, to work together to bring them down.
The thing about thermite, PK, is that thermite is, even in its nano version, is non-explosive. So the only way you get explosive out of thermite is to combine it with explosives, which, as I've observed on other occasions, is also true of toothpaste. But thermite is a cutter charge, but all the demonstrations I've ever seen suggest it acted too slowly in cutting beams to have been responsible for the rapid demolition of the Twin Towers. Plus, when you use thermite to cut beams, you know, at these angles, you're counting on gravity to bring the building down. So you have a classic controlled the demolition with a stack of pancakes. And in the case of a 110-story buildings, 12% would be 10% would be 11 floors, and another 2%. 2.2 more. So you should have 13 to 14 floors of pancakes. And of course, as Father Frank observed, they were destroyed below ground level. So thermite may have played some role here, but it cannot be a principal ingredient. Something else was involved, and it may very well have been mini nukes.
Well, that's interesting. And when you think of the motives, we didn't really get to get into. I'll say in closing, when I look at who benefited from 9/11, in my humble yet all-knowing opinion, it is, of course, Israel and the military-industrial complex because of the war that followed.
I gave a public speech on the Capitol grounds, on the grass in front of the Capitol, on 15 April 2008 during the Ron Paul Freedom Rally. And it's been published under the title of 9/11 and the Neocon Agenda. It even wound up on the front page of the Daily Poll, where I explained that the motives appeared to have been for oil, Israel, and ideology. Oil taking control of this vast supply in Iraq and either leaving it in the ground to elevate the price of the other supply in the world or taking it out on the cheap. There was even a plan to run a pipeline to the Mediterranean through Israel, which would have allowed Israel to tap into it and solve its energy needs, probably completely off the cuff.
Of course.
And Israel resented the modern and sophisticated state of Iraq, where they had a national health care system, national public education. They had a viable infrastructure providing reliable water and electricity, antiquities and artifacts dating back thousands of years. And Saddam was offering, you know, bounties of $25,000 to the families of suicide bombers. But then there was the ideology of taking advantage of the unique historical circumstance of the United States being the only remaining superpower, moving American military force into the center of the Middle East and then projecting it outward from that geopolitically sensitive area in an attempt to create a worldwide empire. If you read the documents for Project of the New American Empire, New American Century, because they thought the United States would dominate the world for the next 100 years, they bemoan the fact that there's this unique historical opportunity, but the American people are unlikely to be supportive of wars of aggression such as they would require because they're contrary to American practice and ideals, unless there were some motivating, unifying event like a new Pearl Harbor. And that's exactly what they arranged to bring us on 9/11.
And, of course, that ties in exactly with Mossad's mantra, which is, by deception, we make war.
I have no doubt that the Mossad was deeply involved in the events of 9/11.
And Israel resented Iraq also because Iraq had the largest Arab army in the Middle East. However, Saddam was not a nice guy, but Iraq had the largest number of college-educated Arabs. It was a secular Muslim country, which you think the neocons would want anyway. Saddam fought against fundamentalism for over 30 years. Women did not have to dress a certain way. Alcohol was tolerated. There was a small Jewish community, a small Christian community, and Saddam kept a lid on this sectarian violence. He didn't allow this sectarian fighting between the different tribes and whatnot. So they destroyed, a modern, secular, more modern Arab country, which is a very shame in retrospect. They made it much worse.
PK, everything you're saying is true. I only wish every American knew those things because they're very important. This was all contrived. It was phony, demonizing Saddam like we've demonized Gaddafi. Gaddafi shares the resources of Libya with all of his people. He gives them socialized medicine, national health care. We don't have national health care here in the United States. Wonderful education. You know, sometimes he'll give every citizen $500 in oil benefit. This Gaddafi appears to be actually quite a good guy, even if he can be, you know, criticized from some respects as Saddam. But what we're doing here is completely god-awful and a violation of human rights, and it's a disgrace that the United States is attacking these Arab countries.
You're right. And with that, Jim, I'd like to thank you, and also I'd like to thank Rebecca for calling. I hope she'll join us again next week. I've got to wind this down now. So, Jim, thanks again so much for coming on. It's always great to speak with you and hear what you have to say, and I hope you like the atmosphere here on Third Stream View.
Oh, yeah, I enjoy it a lot, PK. Thanks very much for having me. Anytime.
You're welcome, and I'm sorry I forgot when we first started this evening. I'm sorry I forgot to offer you some tea or coffee. Thanks again, Jim. And here's where I do my little sign-off spiel. So I would like to thank our listeners again for tuning in to Third Stream View, which is on every Monday evening. And I'd like to thank our host, bbsradio.com. It's always a pleasure to speak with my invited guests. I hope you'll tune in next week. And until then, this is PK, your humble host, saying good night, take care, and I hope you tune in next Monday evening. Thanks again.